Welcome, by the way, to Super Together. I'm James Cochran.
And I'm Ginger Rothis.
And we're talking about Hamilton today.
We're both smiling.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. So everybody's watching Hamilton. And if you haven't, pause the show and go and watch Hamilton or read Ron Chernow's biography of Hamilton.
That's how we got started. So my daughter read Chernow's biography in fifth grade.
Whoa. That's like a heavy read,
right? It's a heavy read. She was so determined. And so we would, like, about halfway through, it started to get heavy and dense, so we would play the audible and she would read along in the book sometimes, but she was so determined to get through it, so that was, she wanted to read it all before we saw the musical.
That's
so
funny.
Yeah, and in fifth grade she was obsessed. She had this awesome history teacher that just kind of enabled the obsession and had so much fun with her. Yeah, so that's how we got our start. Okay, I interrupted you.
No, I don't even remember what I was saying, but we so as we watched it, and I'd listened to the soundtrack maybe for the past couple of years since it's been available to listen to, and just felt like, man, like, this is a, so we're not here to talk about, like, historical,
this isn't
as much of a review of Hamilton. I think that we would both give it, you know, several stars. It's more about what comes through is the way that relationships shape so much of how the plot plays out. The sort of central dynamic, and maybe you could argue that there's two, but are between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. And but then there's also Alexander Hamilton and his wife, Eliza. And then sort of a triangle with
Eliza
Angelica.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to it. I figured, and I didn't prepare you for this at all.
Okay.
Do you think I've seen them do this on other podcasts. One of my favorite podcasts is Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. And for each show, they do a 30-second recap.
Oh, cool.
So we're splitting this into a two-parter. So I'm going to encourage you or challenge you to do a 30-second recap of Act 1, because today we're going to talk about Act 1.
Okay.
So I will let you know when your time's up. You have 30 seconds to tell us what happened in Act 1. Ready, set.
Oh my gosh, I'm on the spot.
Okay, yeah, like I said, zero preparation.
So the lyrics are coming. Immigrant,
okay.
Orphan.
Okay, go.
All right, Alexander Hamilton grows up immigrant, orphan, moves to the United States, determined to get a degree, sees the circle of influence growing that possibly could change the world, gets inspired, brings people along with him, gets married, really in love with his sister, but that's complicated. And then frenemy Burr turns on him, and I'm not sure where Act 1 ends, but Washington's president, Jefferson's on the scene, Madison.
Okay.
So
you went past Act 1, which is fine, and I gave you more like 39 seconds. So if I was going to do, because I actually have the Wikipedia plot summary in front of me.
That's
Alexander Hamilton, he's born in the Caribbean they call him a bastard and an orphan. Father's not in the picture, mother dies young, comes to the United States, energetic about his education, but also about joining the American Revolution. He becomes a trusted aide to General George Washington. At that same time, he marries Eliza Schuyler, but there's also a sense that Angelica has feelings for Hamilton, but sort of puts those to the side because she feels like she has a responsibility to marry someone of a higher social standing. So there's more and more of that. There's this Aaron Burr is sort of, I would look at him as like the MC or the narrator. He is sort of, he weaves his way through the story in these interesting ways. He comes from money, also an orphan, but is more of a, you know, well-to-do, established
Princeton,
kind of person. Yeah. And so he is sort of present in all the same spheres that Hamilton is, but is much more of a, wait and see kind of person. And he has a really awesome song called Wait For It. But so sort of positions himself in the background, you know, doesn't really take a stand for much, just sort of like goes where there is opportunity, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the revolution kind of wraps up. They, you know, the spoiler alert, the United States comes out of the American Revolution. There is... So they sort of, they ratify the Constitution or create the Constitution, and then Hamilton sort of works as he's the Secretary of the Treasury, writes the Federalist Papers in defense of that. So Eliza is like, I would rather you not go and do all of that. And Hamilton's like, no, I need to go and work in this way. So that brings us to the end of Act One.
Okay.
So I'm just curious, as you... looked at that, and I know that you put on a Facebook post that got like a bunch of comments.
Cool.
Yeah, that was people really engaged about like what are the different relationships, the relationship dynamics that are kind of present in Act One. What sticks out to you as some of the more prominent types of things that are worthy of discussion?
Well, I love human relationships in every musical, so I think I naturally gravitate to that in this one too. And I think that the overlying themes of what does it mean to be human, what does it mean to make a contribution during our time on the earth, I think Hamilton really speaks to that. That you know, there's this sense in all of us that we want our lives to matter and we want our work to make a difference.
Yeah,
we all approach that very differently. And then the complicated nature of human relationships, we see it so beautifully illuminated in the relationship between Eliza and Angelica and their loyalty to one another and how they want the best for the other one, truly. And then in Hamilton and Eliza's relationship, which is complicated, and he has this bigger sense of calling, and you see her supporting that, but also she deserves to be treated well in the process and respected, and but she really takes kind of a supportive role to him. And then, you know, I think that those pieces of the musical intrigue me more than the history. I learned a lot of history through watching it that I had no idea Hamilton was kind of the, you know, started the banking, the federal banking system. So his brilliance and genius was new to me in the story, but the complicated relationships, I think, are what I really have always enjoyed every time I've watched it.
Yeah. I, you know, there's the opening song, you know, Alexander Hamilton, I think is the name of the song, really outlines a lot of the things that are going to happen, a lot of how the characters unfold. And, you know, I mean, Aaron Burr in the opening song says, I'm the damn fool that shot him.
Yes.
I don't think we'll have to use an explicit tag for saying damn.
Yeah.
But to me, I think I was most intrigued by the relationship of Burr and Hamilton, because there is this this connection that's portrayed in the musical. Now, again, we won't speak to how much of that is historically accurate. Mm-hmm. We don't really know. But, you know, there is what we see in... Hamilton, you know, is his first interaction with Burr is sort of seeking him out for his guidance. Like, it's like, you graduated really fast. How'd you do it? How can I do the same things that you did?
Mm-hmm.
And almost immediately, as Burr sort of articulates his philosophy of like, listen, talk less, smile more, don't take a stand on things, you know, that immediately rubs Hamilton the wrong way. And we see him, you know, join this other band of folks who are more passionate, energetic, taking a stand immediately.
Yep, exactly.
And I think that the way that that relationship evolves and changes over time, just it just fascinates me, because I think about there are so... Most of the examples that I would have of that in my own life are with... like family, like people that you can't, like you can't get rid of, you know, like it would strike me that like if Burr and Hamilton, you know, are this sort of, they respect each other, but they're sort of at odds with each other, like just leave each other alone. And so it's, I think that the, what it teaches us potentially is that the sort of the cauldron in which the United States was born was this, you know, it was a lot of the same people interacting in a lot of the same circles, and they couldn't shake each other no matter how much they tried. And so they were sort of constantly being sort of thrown into relationship with each other. So there was this sort of mutual respect and admiration. And I think I have a lot of curiosity about how we navigate those relationships in our lives where we say, man, I have some, I disagree with you in some fundamental ways, but I also still want to be in relationship with you. I'm thinking about, you know, this upcoming election year and how, like, you know, we're going to be, it's going to be clearer than ever that there are people in our lives who we disagree with and have totally different views and opinions than we do. And I mean, certainly a lot of that has come out in the last, you know, 6 months or so with how do we respond to the COVID-19 pandemic? How do we respond to the Black Lives Matter movement? But I think it's going to be, again, thrown into sharp relief again with the election. So I'm just curious, like, when you look at people in your life who are, who you can't really shake from your life, but you know disagree with you, how do you navigate that?
You know, to me, it's a lot of ego management in myself. Mm. Like, do I have to be right? What am I trying to achieve here? And I think that we see that in Burt and Hamilton a little bit of, like, the egos flare as their as we learn more about their relationship, and this jealousy ensues, and this, I want to be right. I want to be the one that goes down in history, which comes back to that drive we have to contribute and make the world a better place. And I think that that's what we're seeing in politics is, you know, on each side, people really believe they have the answer to make it better.
Yeah.
Right. And yet we disagree with what the answer is to make it better. And so whether it's, you know, a Democratic platform of let's help everyone. If one is suffering, we're all suffering. Mm-hmm. Kind of this general, you know, more compassion approach, whereas the Republican platform also says if you do that, you can't sustain the economy, and we have to have some natural, supply and demand kind of tension, or the whole thing crumbles. And so I can see that both approaches could be right, and both have the intention of saving our country and contributing and making it better, which is, I think, what we see in the Hamilton musical. But I think what becomes the question for each of us is, what's my motive? What's my ego doing in this? Is this about me being right and winning? Or is this really about the greater good and what would help our country?
Yeah. It's interesting as you were describing that idea of, like, where does our ego fall into it? I'm thinking, this is, I believe, in Act 1, where General Lee, I think, is... you know, he's given command, doesn't do very well, and then starts bad-mouthing George Washington.
Yeah.
And Washington's like, let it go. Yeah. Like, we've got other priorities here. Mm-hmm. As your commanding officer, like, I'm telling you, don't do anything about this.
Yeah.
And so then, I think Hamilton enlists John Lawrence to duel Lee, like, on his, so he'll be his second or whatever, so he's not confronting it directly. But I think it speaks to, like, a sort of mature way of being, like, exactly. Rohr would call it, like, first half of life, second half of life. Yeah. Like, first half of life, we're very much interested in, like, identity formation and identity, like, preservation, and, like, that there's a lot of ego there. Mm-hmm. In George Washington, I think, at least as he's portrayed in the musical, is very much like a, hey, listen, like our priority is, like, protecting this budding nation, creating this budding nation. I'm not at all interested in, like, someone bad mouthing me. Like, that doesn't get under my skin in the same way that it gets under Alexander and Burr's skin. Mm-hmm. And so I think seeing that, I think, is an ideal example of what you're describing, which is that when we find ourselves in a relationship with people who are sort of at odds with us, like, the best way to maintain relationship with them is to recognize that, like, okay, like, I don't need to let the fact that we are different bother me at sort of a personal level. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah. And it's interesting, the two halves of life thing, because Burr and Hamilton are young, you know, and so we see this, this deep, deep drive and kind of young urgency and spirit in a lot. And then as they age, we see Hamilton in Act 2 kind of mellow.
Gesundheit.
Yeah. Act two, huh? Good job. That was funny.
That was a joke. I was in theater in middle school.
I haven't heard that before.
And that's what they said. Anytime anybody said act two, you have to say Gesundheit.
Oh, I've got to teach that to my daughter who's in theater. She probably already knows it. Yeah. But yes, I think that with age, we have perspective and life experiences shape us. And you had mentioned in a text of discussing how childhood shapes us and then how, you know, society shapes us. And I think that that's another real theme in Hamilton is watching Hamilton's drive and ambition and, you know, starting from nothing and odds against him and the, you know, writing like you're running out of time kind of urgency. That really inspired me the first time I saw it of like, we've got a lot of work to do and time is running out. And, you know, and that really spoke to me personally. But this I've always wondered, do people who grow up with more adversity and hardships have a sense of nothing to lose in that drive and ambition? I don't know.
Yeah.
I have examples of that in my own life of seeing people that started. I mean, my parents are examples of that, of like they didn't grow up with a lot and they were determined to work and educate themselves and pay for everything and avoid debt. And, you know, they just had this different drive than other people I know who just life was more comfortable. So I think that I saw that too in the Burr-Hamilton kind of relationship. They were both orphaned, but Burr had these educational opportunities and kind of the sophisticated way of being. And Hamilton was young and scrappy and, you know, there's something to be said for that. So how do you think childhood shaped them?
Yeah, it's interesting as you describe that. So we'll mention Rohr a second time in the podcast. He talks about this idea, like if you've never lost, like if you walk through life and you don't have like some humiliation, some loss, some sort of deep pain, then you essentially what's happened is you've never had your sort of core ego identity formation challenged, which makes it harder for you to, you know, evolve into that second half of life, maturity, wisdom, where you realize like, oh, it's actually not all about me. It's not like I don't have to just completely be focused on ego preservation, because you can see how fragile your own capacity is, your own ego is. But if you're always winning, if you never have an opportunity to lose, then you never really face that in the same way. And so I think that Hamilton like immediately is just faced with hardship. And I think that in a lot of ways that galvanizes his focus, his energy, his sort of sense of like seizing opportunity. And I think Burr, you know, I almost think about like people who play poker like really aggressively and then people who like play really conservatively. So I mean, you know, if you start out with the same number of chips, like if you have a ton of chips and then someone else starts out, I'm changing the analogy a little bit, with like not very many chips and then accumulates those chips, they're going to be more inclined to play aggressively because like I know what it's like to have nothing. I need to continue to pursue that energy toward doing that. Whereas someone with a lot of chips, like they don't want to lose them. Lots, you know, they're going to be like, they're going to, you know, you know, and which strategy is the right strategy, I think, is a less relevant question than how do we take responsibility for those strategies in the way that we show up in our relationships. I was, you know, in one of the things that we do in couples work is we do this multi-generational genogram where we look at your brothers and sisters, your parents and their brothers and sisters, and then their parents and their brothers and sisters, and really start to explore the relationships. And I used an analogy in a session last night that I hadn't used before. And maybe it's relevant with Hamilton, is when we look at those sort of formative experiences and the way that we sort of are taught to understand those relational dynamics, it's almost like we're being given a costume. And then being given that costume dictates how we show up into certain spaces. And part of what we do in couples work or in genogram work is we say, I want you to recognize that you were given that costume and you find yourself gravitating towards spaces where that costume works well, to where you can move comfortably in that costume. But part of what we have to recognize is that that costume might not be ideal for all situations and all circumstances. And so you have to just, okay, so do I want to keep wearing this? Do I want to keep parts of it and let part of it go? But when we just sort of, when we move through our life uncritically and we just say like, I'm just, you know, which is, I think, ultimately what both Hamilton and Burr do to their sort of detriment is Hamilton is sort of, he's given this costume, this animating force of, if there's an opportunity, I have to seize it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what it costs me. It doesn't matter what it costs my relationships. It doesn't, I don't have to think twice about it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to seize on that opportunity. Whereas Burr is somebody who says like, I don't want to, put my neck out in a way that's going to hurt me. Mm-hmm. I don't want to risk my legacy, risk my, you know, I've got too much to lose. And I think that the song Wait For It, illustrates the, how Burr understands this dynamic where he's like, you know, I think the lyrics go, Hamilton, faces an endless uphill climb. He has something to prove. He has nothing to lose.
Yes, exactly.
You know, this idea that like he understands him as this person who's is all of his energy is around of course he's going to seize every opportunity. He's not risking anything.
Yeah.
Whereas Burr feels like, you know, I'm somebody who's lying in wait. Like I have to wait for my opportunity because I don't want to, you know, it's like, again, thinking back to that poker thing, you know, just waiting for the right hand to come along. And then once that right hand comes along, he plays it. And where I think Hamilton finds that most frustrating is that it isn't the result of any belief or conviction. It seems to be all oriented around opportunity.
Yeah.
I think this, I'm not sure if this is an act one or an act two deal, but when he runs for, Hamilton's father-in-law's
yes.
Senate seat, I mm-hmm. think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, like, you know, does so because there's an opportunity to do so rather than like, oh yeah, I have this conviction. I want to make New York better. And
right.
all this, at least that's the way Hamilton sees it.
Right.
So yeah, I think that's where how those childhood experiences, start to shape us. And again, I think where Burr and Hamilton both, and maybe it's just because of, you know, what we see in the musical is most of their first half of life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't ever see them take a closer look at, man, like, how do I, how is this way that I taught to be in the world not serving me?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for both of them, it serves them in some really problematic ways. Whether or not they choose to pay attention to it, is ultimately the sort of, that's the task of life and a task that we don't see them get around to.
Right. Well, and what you're speaking to is kind of these blind spots we all mm-hmm. have of not being able to observe ourselves sometimes or step out of ourselves and see what's playing out in our lives. And,
yeah.
and I think Hamilton, you know, kind of does, learns that lesson the hard way when he is, making work and contribution to the Constitution his priority.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have the ability to kind of step out and observe how is this affecting Eliza? How is this affecting Philip, their son? How is this affecting me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we watch as he's the hero of the story, but then I think we also have to step back and say, for each of us, you know, is our hero's journey, is there collateral damage that I'm not seeing?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, step back of, and that's such a hard line. I mean, when I work with women who the husband has a big job and she wants a big job too,
mm-hmm.
you know, there is some reality that we can't all chase our dreams at the exact same time, right? When you have little kids at home. And
yeah.
and so I think you feel that tension in Hamilton's life of like, whose dream is most important here?
Mm-hmm.
Is it Eliza? You know, I think about Come Away from the Summer. That may be an act mm-hmm. too. But this idea of your family needs you and he responds with the country needs me. And
mm-hmm.
who, you know, I think we're always in the tension in our human lives of what are our priorities and what is most important. And we all define that differently, but giving each other space for that sometimes is hard. And so I think we find that relationship theme in this too. And one of my Facebook friends, Sarah Sturm, said, humanity's greatest weakness and greatest strength is free will. And, you know, I think that gets to these choices we have to make.
Mm-hmm.
We are given the free will to make these choices. And which choices will you make? And if we look back at history, Hamilton made an a huge contribution, a genius level contribution to our country, mm-hmm. as far as the banking system and the Constitution. And, you know, we could argue that deeper, and we won't today. But if we just look at what was his, did he make a contribution? Yes, his life mattered in that sense. And then Eliza picks up on his work, which I love mm-hmm. too. Oh, mm-hmm. I should save that for part two.
Yeah, that's fine. These are the great, these are great teasers for people to listen next week.
Yes, listen to part two.
I think that there is a, this idea of free will is so, I think, challenging for us. And especially because with the context of like history, I think it would be easy for us to say, you know, that these people were products of their time, that they were, you know, just sort of living into the spaces that they were sort of called to live into. But I think part of what we see is there is a, I mean, you see it with Angelica and Eliza and the different approaches that they take. You see it with Hamilton and Burr, you know, later on with like Jefferson and Hamilton. And I think that there is a, we do have a lot more agency generally than we give ourselves credit for. And it's really only with the hindsight of history that we say, oh yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's kind of the way that they had to approach it. And sometimes you'll look at something that somebody doesn't even be like, that's, that was, I wonder why they approached it that way. That was a little bit bizarre. But generally speaking, like, I think that one of the things that I, will confront couples with is I give every couple pretty much the same assignment every time they come in and meet with me is I want you to have a 30-minute conversation every single day where it's just focused on becoming more connected. No other agenda, no other outcome, just focus on becoming more connected. And I get usually get some resistance. I mean, it's a scale. So some people are more resistant than others, but usually the resistance is built around like, we're too busy for that. You know, how do we, when are we going to find 30 minutes in our day? And I tell them two things. I say, one, I'm asking you for 3.5 out of every 168 hours. There's 168 hours in a week, and I'm asking you to use 3.5 of those to focus on your most important relationship. And then two, it's like, it's, if you think about what is your most important relationship or what's most important to you, how much time are you willing to devote to that? Or how much are you willing to make it a priority? And so, you know, there's, I hear people say, and again, I think we should probably acknowledge that the way that we would look at the practice of free will in the space of relationships is probably something that comes from privilege, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's easy for me to say that to most couples, but then there are some couples who say, I work three jobs and our shifts never coincide. We never see each other. We see each other for 15 minutes a week. Fair enough. But generally speaking, part of what I look to when I'm connecting with couples is saying, you get to decide whether you can or can't do it. Saying that, well, I have to go to work. I remember this was a few weeks ago. I was meeting with, actually it might've been just last week. I was meeting with my therapist and I was just having a hard time. Just life was just super, super heavy. I'm a 5 on the Enneagram. And so that I have a limited reservoir of energy and, which is strange being a therapist where, you know, and I was just like, I just feel like I need like 3 days where I don't have to be responsible to anybody. And she was like, well, why don't you take 3 days? And that thought had literally just like, it never even occurred to me as a possibility. And I think about Hamilton and, and the way that Eliza says like, hey, I need you to, you know, come and be with your family and be connected with us. And like, I think in his mind, he's saying, well, I can't do that. And again, when we say we can't do something, essentially we're removing our own agency from the situation. Exactly. We're imagining we don't have free will. Like I have to do this. I don't have the freedom to do that. And again, it's, the reason we're afraid of the consequences, we're afraid of, for Hamilton, I think he's afraid of, well, what am I going to, what opportunity am I going to miss by not being engaged in this? Who's going to take my spot if I'm not engaged in this space in this way? And I think that if that's the most authentic expression of who we are, that's fair. But as we've said a couple times now, most of the time that is unexamined. We just assume like, oh, well, because this is the way I've trained myself to be, the only way I can approach this is by saying, oh, well, I have to go to work. I have to go and be in, I was probably in New York at the time. I have to go and engage in these spaces because that's what my duty demands of me. Instead of saying, well, that's, you know, that's the way I've trained myself to be, but is that what's most authentic for me? Is that what the best expression of myself is?
Right. I think this, Yeah, I love the agency kind of thing and the forgetting to examine our agency or to forgetting to examine that we make choices and we do have free will in this and you can design the life, you know, with privilege, you can design the life that you want to live. And what's interesting, I think what I was thinking with those kind of choices of do I go away with my family for the summer or do I, you know, continue to try to change the country, are you making this decision from a place of fear or love?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that becomes really an important reconciliation tool in my brain all the time.
Yeah.
Of am I, you know, when I am faced with a decision or a choice, I really have to examine, is this coming from a place of love or fear? And I think you spoke to it with Hamilton. Do I lose my spot? Does somebody mm-hmm. else get the upper hand? Does my goal not get achieved? You know, maybe it's not competitive as much as now is the time I have to make this dream happen.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all fear language.
Right? Yeah,
that's
yeah.
scarcity of I'm running out of time. And then love would be, I have this amazing family and maybe my best ideas will come when I go away for the summer. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and looking at the potential is always kind of the loving path, I think. And some circumstances are clearer than others for me on, am I choosing from fear or love? But oftentimes my worst decisions come from a place of fear
mm-hmm.
and my best decisions come when I follow that love. And if we look at how it played out for Hamilton, that decision to stay that summer did not bring out the best in him
mm-hmm.
and he didn't make great decisions and then that horribly affected his family. And you know, so that pivotal moment of choosing a fearful scarcity mentality, and I'm speaking for what he was thinking, right? I'm
yeah.
just observing the, and it's Turneau's story to tell, and it's Lin-Manuel Miranda's story to tell, but it seemed to me like Hamilton chose fear in mm-hmm. that moment, and
yeah.
had he chosen love, I, you know, who knows?
Yeah, I think that is a fair summation of, you know, the animating experience of really, I don't want to say a lot of the founding fathers, but like there is a lot of it is just oriented around, well, what if this happens? Well, what
yeah.
if that happens?
Yeah.
Really considering, and I suppose that there's value in that and there's a need for that. And there's a sense of like, we need to be able to protect this kind of sense. But one of the things that we know about the Constitution and the way that it was written and that we know about like the founding fathers is that they were not, like a lot of that fear, protected people of a certain
yeah,
social class.
Exactly.
They protected, you know, landowning white
mm-hmm.
males, so to speak. And they, you know, didn't give voice. And one of the true historical criticisms of Alexander Hamilton is that he was far more, he wasn't the musical, I think, portrays him as sort of a, silent abolitionist, you know, mm-hmm. somebody who was, he's not against slavery, but he's not doing, whereas I think one of the historical things that I read is that he probably traded slaves on behalf of his father-in-law. And like, mm-hmm. there was more of that to his story, than we would want to necessarily name. So again, I think that, but that's all again based in that sort of protecting the status quo, because changing is really hard.
Yeah.
Doing something truly different is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that one of the more, to me, one of the more interesting, this is, I don't know how much this is relationships, but when King George III, you know, says, what comes next?
Mm-hmm.
You've been free. Do you know how hard it is to lead?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was just like, oh man, like, you know, you and I are both small business owners.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of
yeah.
struck out on our own
yes.
to sort of do our own thing. And I'm thinking like, there is a piece of that is like, okay, we did the thing.
Yeah.
and there's anxiety to it,
totally.
Right? There's anxiety when you're in that space. But again, to your point, when only anxiety drives your decision making, you generally don't end up in a place that is most authentic, most hopeful, most fruitful, most akin to your actual true vision.
Yeah.
And so that is, I think, one of the broader lessons maybe from Act One is like, and we'll see this, you know, we'll see the consequences of it in Act Two.
Yeah.
Gesundheit, but that'll be...
I missed the opportunity.
No, that's fine. That'll be for the next one. Any closing thoughts on Act One anything that you really liked about it, anything that you would look at and say, this was something that I really liked or appreciated.
Yeah, one of the things that I love in Act One is that love triangle brewing between mm-hmm. Angelica, Eliza, and how the way Lin-Manuel Miranda produced it was you do a rewind mm-hmm. and you see, and so first you're watching Eliza's perspective of this party, and then you rewind and you see Angelica's.
Yeah.
And I think that scene speaks so deeply on to our human desires and yet our compassion for others and loyalty to her sister. So if you haven't seen it, Angelica and Hamilton have this chemistry and bond at this party, and you can tell that there's a connection between the two mm-hmm. of them. But then Eliza comes up to her sister and says, you know, I don't know what she says, but basically I want to meet him. And so Angelica pushes her feelings aside and introduces them, and then you know, you never see that same chemistry mm-hmm. between Eliza and Hamilton, but they definitely have this mutual respect, and Angelica realizes her societal role is to marry wealthy, right, for the family, like she sort of judges Hamilton in that moment of mm-hmm. not good enough.
Yeah.
And yet her soul or her subconscious is saying, but follow your heart. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm interpreting all of this happening at the same time. But I think that just summed up for me this human experience we have, and who do we choose to spend our lives with? Who do we love? And where are we making decisions from our head? Where are we making decisions from our heart? Mm-hmm. Where are expectations and pressures put upon us?
Yeah.
I love that. That whole scene to me really captures this universal struggle we have of choosing a partner sometimes.
Yeah. And how many things beyond just like romance go into it, right?
Exactly.
I think one of my favorite moments of the musical, but certainly one of my favorite moments of the first half is the is Wait for It. Leslie Odom Jr. singing in the movie with as Aaron Burr,
mm-hmm.
and when he there's this moment where, and it's so beautifully acted, where he's like his eyes are closed, and it's almost he's singing to himself in this moment of like I am inimitable. I am an original. Like, and I think in that moment he is speaking to his own insecurities,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because I think he's accused of not standing for anything,
right,
of not, being, no one knows kind of what he thinks and what he stands, you know, all this type of stuff. And, for him to just say, no, I am, or I do have an identity. I do have authenticity. And I am making the conscious choice not to act on that because I feel like that's what's best.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that is it's just such an interesting lesson in the ways that we sort of confront our own sense of who we want to be and what we want to do. And again, how much of that is like him being honest with himself and how much of that is of him being, you know, maybe looking at himself with rose colored glasses, is hard to say, but in that moment you can just see the intensity with which he's saying like, this is who I am. This is who I am. Even if nobody else sees it, I believe that this is who I am.
In that same song, there's a line that I love. There are things homilies and hymns don't teach you.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that
yeah.
is that moment of, trying to find his self-worth.
Yeah.
And then in, I think it's right before that scene maybe, is when Angelica says, I learned 300 fundamental truths at the same time. You know, and so I think you're getting at this going back to where is my inherent worth? Mm-hmm. Who am I really? What's my identity?
Yeah.
Not in a selfish way, but more in a grounding way of,
Well, that I think will wrap us up for Act One. If you would like to get in touch with me, you can go to talkingwithjames.com.
And Ginger, or I'm second, first person.
You've done that before.
I can be found at compassionfix.com.
We're going to press stop, and then I think we're going to record act two.
Fine.
But that'll be out next week. So tune in. We'd love to hear what you think about it. We'd love to hear your thoughts on Hamilton. So if you want to get other people connected with the show, we'd love for you to share. You can rate and review on it wherever you're listening to your podcast. All that's really helpful in helping people get connected with our show. Until then, we will see you next week.
And be well.